You know, I also don't play for the Packers, but I'm still rooting for them to win. And so it feels like a very similar thing as far as I am rooting for all of my queer friends to win.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios, Happy Avenue in downtown Milwaukee. Let's start the week by going up front to get the latest on Wisconsin politics statewide with Channel 12 political director Matt Smith on Point Taken.
Happy Monday. It is me, Kristen Bry. Steve is off all week. He will be back next Monday. But we got Matt Smith.
Hi. Good morning.
Full hour. He is spending, he's in studio for an hour talking to me about all the things. Because we only had you on the phone last
last week.
Where were you off to last Monday?
Like a week ago.
Oh, I think the Capitol.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so plenty to talk about. Let's get right into it. President Trump was in Wisconsin on Friday.
Yeah.
I think it was after our show was already over for the day.
Yep.
I think you were on with Wisconsin's Afternoon News.
Yes.
Later in the afternoon after the show, after his roundtable. And it wasn't quite a rally, right? It was about 1,000-ish people, you said?
Yeah. And it was billed as a roundtable on farming. So there was the stage and they all sat around. And if you've ever been to an event with President Trump before, it was a lot of him talking. And then the back end was the roundtable. But these are incredibly long days for the people in the audience, for the people there, because you have the massive Secret Service sweeps. You have to get in. You're waiting. So, like, it is a full day event for a roughly hour presentation when the president is actually there.
So it wasn't a rally, but it was around 1,000 people. So all those people were there just to watch the roundtable?
Yeah, they were in the crowd.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
To watch and to listen and quite frankly to see the president, right? Like these are the president's supporters showing up in the crowd. So he got there mid to late afternoon. He taped the interview with Meet the Press first.
Which we'll talk about.
Yes. And then he came on stage and did the roundtable and talked with some folks who were up there, and then he was off.
All right. Well, so let's hear a little bit about what Trump said to the crowd.
We were having record stuff, and then we had to put out a fire. We had to extinguish a nuclear weapon, a capable nuclear. This was going to be a very capable country that was going to have a massive nuclear presence, and we weren't going to let that happen. Nobody wanted that to happen. And we've largely finished that, you'll see. I hope you people are really spiritized, because we're at a point, we're going to come out of Iran very quickly, and it's going to be very strong, one way or the other, whether it's a piece of paper or the very tough way, okay? The very tough way is maybe the easier way, but we're going to come out, and your fertilizer prices are going to go way down, just like they were 4 months ago.
All right. So talked about Iran.
Yeah.
What else did he talk about?
And listen, I mean, there was a lot of talk, and I think he came right out of the gate essentially saying, I hope you all go vote Republican in the midterms. It's clear the administration has immediately turned its focus to the midterms, while also understanding in however the president delivers it, that there is this issue with Iran, with high fuel prices, with high gas prices, and you hear him here talking to a crowd, and the event was billed as a roundtable on farming, not only here in Wisconsin, but across the country. But the president said something to the effect of good things are going to happen in the next 90 days. And whether that happens or not, we'll have to see. And what those good things are, we'll have to see, right? I mean, more developments in just the past 24 hours. But it was clear the administration was attempting in the prepared remarks to address these concerns that Republicans know are real concerns about the economy and about the impact of Iran.
So it was also interesting because I think as of Friday, we didn't know that this had happened. But obviously, as of yesterday, we did. When did the clip come out from his Meet the Press interview?
About him walking out. That was saved until Sunday, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was it, looking back now, having seen that he did the interview and then came out, could you notice that he was visibly...
Well, he made a comment off the top about how he did an interview with NBC, and he did make a comment about the rain and how he got angry because of the rain. And I will tell you, I mean, we're in pole barns, right? So tin roofs, and I will tell you, at times, and you heard it if you listened to the Meet the Press interview, you can clearly hear the rain coming down. And I will tell you, being in one of those barns, it was loud. It was incredibly loud. The event hadn't started yet, but all of us, we were about 80 feet back from the stage. And we're just saying it's going to be really tough to hear these people talk because the rain was so intense at moments.
So we have, if you're unfamiliar with what happened, yeah. There was a very tense exchange on Meet the Press, and we now know that interview was filmed in Wisconsin. So let's play a little bit of what that sounded like between Kirsten Walker and President Trump.
Your elections are crooked, and you're crooked, and Meet the Press is crooked, and so is ABC and CBS and CNN.
But Mr. President,
you're one-sided, crooked networks. All right, let's call it quits because I've had enough. Thank you, darling. Have a good time.
Mr. President, let's please. I traveled all the way to Wisconsin.
I've sat in the rain with you.
I traveled all the way to Wisconsin.
On and off in the rain, and I've given you enough time. You ought to straighten out your press because you know what?
Mr. President,
a country can never be great with a dishonest press.
Listen, we traveled all the way to Wisconsin for this interview.
So there you go. Kirsten Walker. Sorry, I said her name.
Yeah. You heard the rain there, right?
Yeah.
This, though, was coming off a conversation about California. And the president did talk about California when he came on stage as well with the claims that the election results are rigged. And Kirsten was pushing back, saying, well, this is how it happens in California, that it takes a long time to count. And whether you like that or not, right? I mean, this is the process that's in place. He came out on stage moments after that interview ended. Clearly, nobody in that room knew at the mm-hmm. moment that he essentially walked out on Meet the Press and ended the interview. But he did make a comment right off the top about the rain, how it made him a little angry, and did the interview with NBC. But I will tell you, the rain was intense. Like,
okay.
Being there firsthand, it was some heavy downpour.
Okay.
And there were people standing outside. Not everyone got in. This speaks, and we'll talk about this in a little bit when we talk about the third congressional, but this speaks to the control that the president still has over his own party.
Yep.
His supporters will come hell or high water, standing in monsoon-like rains to see him. And we saw that firsthand. Obviously, we'll talk about big picture polls, but for his core supporters, and whether we know how big that is or not, they are there.
It's still strong.
Yeah.
And the final thing before we go to a break, Jordan Stoltz was also there. And
yeah.
It's interesting. And it's interesting because I don't think he's going to have the same backlash as like a Jackson Dart for yeah. having been there, right?
No. It was one of those lighthearted moments because he had his medals
yeah.
with him. And to be honest, I didn't realize he was on stage initially until they called his name.
Oh.
I mean, I probably wasn't paying attention as closely as I should have been because we're working on our stories and doing everything, you know, as it's late deadline, things are going on. And I'm like, oh my God, there he is. So he walks over and gives a medal to the president and then he puts it on. And he says, I'm not going to give this back to you. And I think everyone for a second was like, wait, is he serious? But at the end, he did give the medal back to Jordan.
All right. He is Matt Smith, political director over at Channel 12. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about what's going on in the 3rd Congressional District. So stay with us on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken, full hour with political director over at Channel 12, Matt Smith. So while you were up in Eau Claire on Friday, you had a chance to talk to Fred Kappas,
yep.
Who is the 3rd Congressional Republican Party chairman?
Of Eau Claire County.
Eau Claire County, yep. Okay. And so you talked to him a little bit about what's happening, because obviously Derek Van Orden is the Republican candidate,
yeah.
He's our current congressman. And once again, Rebecca Cook is trying to unseat him, but first yep. she has to win a primary because it sounds like it's pretty close between her and Emily Burgi.
Yeah.
At least, I mean, they're on the other side of the state, so I
yep.
am not totally up to date with it. But as far as talking to Fred, what did you glean from that conversation?
So it was fascinating to us that in the span of 1 week in the 3rd Congressional, you had Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and you had President Trump both yeah. making visits that week. And I've heard from a lot of Republicans that a ton of the attention, whether it's visits from the administration or high-level Republicans, there's going to be a ton of people in the 3rd Because this is a huge congressional district. Democrats nationally are going to pour a ton of money into this. Republicans are going to pour a ton of money in this to try to keep Derek Van Orden in his seat. Democrats trying to unseat him to regain control of the House. So, like, everyone understands, like, this is the heart, at least when you look at congressional races, of what's going to happen in Wisconsin. So we're going to see a ton of attention in that district. Republicans say they feel good, but know they have challenges, right? Just given history, just given the economy, and however the Democratic primary shakes out, Derek Van Orden is going to need a lot of support. And that's one of, that is one of the reasons we saw the president there on Friday.
So here, let's hear a little bit from Fred Kappas.
How strong is the president's support among Republicans in this part of the state?
Oh, it's very strong.
Yeah.
Very strong.
If gas prices remain high, if they're still high in November, do you think that hurts Republicans?
Well, it might. There might be protest votes. You know, people are on the fence, you know, about Republicans that say, well, gas prices are too high, so I'm going to vote for Rebecca Cook or Francesca Hong. Well, that'd be a dumb thing to do, but, you know, whatever, it's your vote. If you want to throw it away, that's fine.
Just that Wisconsin accent is just priceless. I love it.
Yeah.
And so did you have a chance when you were up there to talk to voters at all and get a vibe for what sentiment feels like?
Yeah. I mean, Derek Van Orden got a huge applause when he came out on stage at the Trump rally or the Trump event, I should say. And there's signs we saw around town. I think Emily Berge has more of a stronghold. When you talk about Eau Claire itself, she's a council member. The question is, and what people have told me, is how far does that reach? Rebecca Cook has run several times, as we know.
And a very good fundraiser.
Yeah. And so she has a better name ID, people would say, across the whole district as a whole. Because the third congressional is a big district.
Yeah.
It's massive.
It's only second to seventh, right?
Yeah. Like you go all the way down to La Crosse and Eau Claire and out east a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, it is a big area to
cover. Yeah, because it goes all the way into Wisconsin Rapids, where my parents are, in Wood County.
So, I mean, it's a big district. And I think the fact that you're seeing already campaign stops, it just shows how high profile it is for the U.S. House.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because how much, you know, we obviously haven't, we've had polling come out as far as what President Trump's approval rating is. And beyond that, when I was up in Cameron, Wisconsin, a couple weeks ago, it was anecdotal, right?
Yeah.
As far as I'm saying, I feel like I see less signs than I used to, but like you can't really measure that as far as how people are feeling about the presidency.
And in the third congressional, this comes from the latest Marquette poll, which is March. But the Trump's approval in that part of the state is a little higher than it is statewide. It was about 49% as a whole in the western and northwestern part of the state. But Republicans acknowledge, and Fred acknowledged this, that their biggest challenge for Republicans is to get people to the polls when Donald Trump isn't on the ballot. Republicans statewide have had that problem. They'll fully acknowledge it, and they know that is one of their biggest challenges headed into November.
Because also, I mean, I can't, because I don't have a photographic memory, but how did those counties look for the Supreme Court race? And I know it's a very different race, but if you think about conservative voter motivation and how little of it we saw in April, how much do you think you can glean that going into the midterms for that part of the state?
Chris Taylor won the third. It wasn't, I forget the exact ratio. It wasn't by a massive amount, but she won it, right?
Because this is also the part of the state that has changed the most since Obama, right?
Yeah.
As far as like, definitely those are the counties that were Obama Trump voters.
Yep. And when you look back at 2024, Trump obviously won the third congressional. His margin was just, it wasn't massive, but it was a little larger than Derek Van Orden and Rebecca Cook, right?
This was 3 points?
Yeah. So Republicans say this visit by Trump, more visits by Trump, they believe will be and need to be instrumental in mobilizing voters to get their attention and to actually get those Republican Trump voters to the polls who have not voted in other elections.
All right. Well, certainly something to watch. Stay with us. Matt Smith is here all hour on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bryce. Steve is off this week. He will be back on Monday. We have Matt Smith, political director over at Channel 12, here with us for the full 10 o'clock hour. We've got a couple minutes before the bottom of the hour news. So let's wrap up our third congressional district happenings. So also happening on Friday ahead of President Trump's visit, one of the candidates for governor from the Democratic ticket, probably the person I would imagine least likely to host a protest, was hosting a protest, or at least leading a protest, which was Missy Hughes, who is from the 3rd Congressional District. Like, this is her part of the state. Did you guys visit the protest at all? Do we know how many people showed up? Was it effective?
No, we were not there ourselves. When you go to these presidential events, and this is any president, you're locked in for a very long period of time. You have to get through the security sweep.
As
and
all
then,
Knicks fans will find out tonight.
Yes. So you're really locked into that event. So I didn't get a firsthand look of that. So I know she joined some protesters at the airport. There were some protesters, as close as they could get out to the site, out at the farm. But it's curious to see how these candidates are responding. Mandela Barnes was up in the area a couple days before Trump's visit, talking with farmers himself and obviously painting a contrast, to what farmers were telling the president just in terms of the economy. It's fascinating just to see how these candidates are attempting to take on Trump in their own way.
I just thought, I mean, it was nothing, it's not a criticism. It's more of just thinking about, I think it's not a stretch to say Missy and Joel are two of the more moderate candidates. Yeah. And so when you think about leading a protest, you're more likely to think Francesca Hong and not Missy. And so, but obviously, like, in the attempt to continue to get your name out there and have people talking about you, it's not a bad strategy.
And you've seen all of them in some degree, to different levels, come out against Trump because, they know they have to win over the base as they go to the primary. But the question is, and I know the governor has wrestled with this as well, is like, there are instances where you have to work with the Trump administration. And you need the Trump administration, whether it be for federal assistance, for flooding, or what have you. So, I mean, there is this weird balance that has to happen.
Absolutely. All right. Plenty more to get to, including governor race updates. So stay with us. He's Matt Smith. I'm Kristen Bryant. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry. Steve is off for the week. We got Matt Smith here for the rest of the half hour talking about all things Wisconsin politics and reporting. All right, so the two big things I want to talk about before you leave.
Yeah.
Let's start with continued...
I know what you're going to talk about.
Are we talking about... I don't know. Do we call it fall? Like, this is... It's hilarious to me how long this story has lasted when it comes to, like... a bill. Like, to me, it's not like a super sexy topic, and it is because everyone's struggling, but it is funny. Like, this is going on, what, a month?
Close.
5 weeks?
Yeah.
As far as how often you've been on here, and we're talking about the fallout from the property tax surplus bill falling apart. And so since last, when we had you on the phone last week, Voss had just been on your show.
Yes.
And now we have continued clips and conversations that you've had in the last week.
And the last week was really fascinating because you're right. Voss came on the show a week ago from Sunday.
Eager to talk.
Let's go. Yeah. Yes. Very eager to talk. On Monday, I talked with the Senate's top Democrat, Dianne Hesselbein, and she said, absolutely no way. The Senate's not coming back in. I talked to the Majority Leader, Devin Lemahue. We're not doing it. A few days later.
She also was like, if there was changes, we would think about it, but he's not. It sounds like there's no openness to changes from what the bill was.
Then on Thursday, Devin Lemahue came out and said, no, we're going to come in if we can get two votes flipped. And he really targeted more so the 15 Senate Democrats. There were three Republicans who voted against it as well and said, no, if we get two votes to flip, we will definitely come back in and repass it. So clashing there, clashing between the Senate's top Democrat and the governor still last week, all over this deal that just imploded in the state Senate.
So let's hear a little bit, because we have a clip from both what Hesselbein said to you guys, but also Evers not mincing words either. No.
What do you make of the governor saying this was a bad move for Democrats?
Well, the governor is certainly entitled to his position. And what I've said before, and I will say it again, Governor Evers is a good man. Governor Evers is a really great governor. We just disagree on this one issue. One issue out of like 99%, 100% of what we tried to get done. And we'll move on.
My guess is it's going to be no way because she controls, who's going to be head of the Joint Finance Committee on the Senate side. And I'm sure she's given promises there. She gives promises just like other leaders do. I haven't spent a lot of time doing that, but that's what happens in the legislature. I'm sure she's got people wrapped around her finger by giving them jobs that they want.
Like I said, Evers not mincing words as far as...
No.
But that is, I mean, in her defense, that is how you whip votes, right? It's mm-hmm. like you have power over their career
yeah.
to a certain extent when you are a minority or majority leader, and that's the leverage that you have. And so with... Because you also asked Hesselbein her reaction to the poll that came out. And yeah. what did she say about that?
She said, listen, I mean, we understand people's concerns. And Democrats, especially in the Senate, have kept going back to this, the potential for a projected deficit from this deal, a structural deficit. That report from the Fiscal Bureau does incorporate zero economic growth over the next couple years.
Which rarely.
Yeah,
that
hasn't happened
doesn't really
since
happen.
The recession, 2008, 2009.
But we don't know, yeah.
Yeah, so like, we don't know, yes, but historically speaking, right? So that has been their talking point. And the question is that, and people we've talked to is does that resonate to voters? And how much of an issue, if any, will this be come November, depending on what gas prices are, what the economy is, what fuel prices are, property taxes are going to be a huge debate, I think, in this governor's race and probably legislative races. And it'll be curious to see if any of these, especially state Senate candidates, if they really try to hold on to these votes in these races, because at least as of now, it doesn't appear that anyone's going to flip, which means no one's going to come back and revote. And time is ticking on that, too. We're already in June.
So for some of the Democrats who are in these really competitive mm-hmm. Senate races, so I think of I'm forgetting the numbers, but,
yeah.
There's like four or five that are
that's
tight.
Really
and there's also a
yeah.
lot of them don't have an incumbent.
Yeah.
Do you think for a Democrat who's running as a to take this seat or flip this seat, is this like a talking issue for them? Like, is that how pertinent this thing is for them to campaign on? I would have voted yes, because they don't obviously have a voting record because they're not in there right now. Like,
yeah.
is that where we're at with how important this deal was, that people who are on the like running, that they're talking about it while they're talking to constituents?
Or yeah,
is it really just I'm still convinced that it's a lot of political people talking about this versus the average voter.
It could be. And it has taken on a life of its own in the political world for sure. The question is, I think when people hear the top lines, right, like rebate checks, property tax relief, no tax on tips for overtime for service workers, more money
funding.
For special education funding, right? Like, and the Marquette poll showed this, right? Like when you lay it out like that, everyone was like, well, yeah, why wouldn't you pass that, right? I mean, so there's deeper concerns for those who voted no for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You had some of the governor candidates weigh in. So, like, that's why I think this has lived on for as long as it has, because so many people got involved. And it imploded in such dramatic fashion that you don't see these votes cross party lines like they did, or a deal by the Democratic governor and Republican leaders negotiated and introduced as if they were fully confident it was just going to pass through the legislature, we would sign it, and we would move on, and everyone would claim a victory ahead of November.
Well, it is kind of interesting. What do you make of the fact that Lemahieu couldn't flip Hutton or Steve Nass, considering they're not running again?
Yeah, and I've had,
like, what do they have to lose or gain?
We had Chris Kapica on the show, and I've had a number of people who said for sure Kapica and Nass were never a yes vote.
Okay.
So who you believe on this story, I guess, is who you believe, right? Like, Kapica told us he was never a yes vote and told him that. Leaders, Republican leaders and the governor, said they were fully convinced that they had the votes. So whoever said what to indicate that those votes were there, clearly that was not right or misguided or what have you, or they were just based on assumptions, right? Maybe LeMahieu assumed that the Republicans would get on board. Maybe the governor's team assumed that a couple Democrats in the Senate would vote, right? So, like, whatever the calculations were, it didn't work out that way. And that's the fascinating thing of politics, right?
That's the thing when you assume.
Keeps us sure does. Keeps us talking how many weeks later.
Exactly. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about status with the governor's race, who's on the ballot, who's not on the ballot, what's left in the next 2 months, almost exactly 2 months, until the primary. So keep it here with Matt Smith and me, Kristen Bry, on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry. We're talking to Matt Smith for two more segments before we let him get on with his day reporting over at Channel 12, political director. All right, so last week, I don't think papers were due yet. Had papers been turned in yet for all the candidates?
No. June 1st. Well, Monday was the deadline.
Monday 5 was the deadline. So since then, we know for the governor's race, at least for the Democrats, Brett Halsey did not make the ballot.
Correct.
Zach Roper?
I believe yes. The Republican, yes.
No, that's Andy Matt.
Yes, Mance. Yeah. Zach
Roper did not.
And yes, dropped out.
And then Kirk Bangstad did not. He had a bunch of papers that had the wrong date on it.
Yeah.
I know that I saw, I think you maybe retweeted it, a fiery exchange he had with my colleagues over at the Journal Sentinel, who reported that he would not be on the ballot. And he had an expletive for them as far as he had time still to cure some of his papers to still try to get on. Do we think he's going to be able to get that done?
We'll find out tomorrow when the Elections Commission finalizes the ballot and looks at all of that. From people I've talked to, it appears unlikely, based on the number of issues that were found. And the Election Commission found that he only had like 1,500 valid signatures. You need at least 2,000. People get more than that. Yeah. You can gather between 2,000 and 4,000 just to be safe. He didn't even meet the 2,000 threshold based on the Election Commission criteria and to some of the issues you pointed out, wrong dates. We've seen his Facebook posts kind of outlining his process of how he's tried to get in touch with people, with some of the signature gatherers, like listing names of people he needs to find and get in contact with. So we'll find out tomorrow. And that appears, big picture, there haven't been any challenges to any of the major candidates on the ballot. There were some challenges in the 7th Congressional. Those will be heard the following day because...
For the Republicans or for the Democrats?
Yes, for the Republicans.
Okay.
And I don't know specifically all of those, exactly what all the details are in terms of what signatures are challenged or where and what papers. But there was an extension on that, so those will be the next day. But for what the commission has to do tomorrow, it appears all the major candidates for governor... beyond Kirk Bankstead, will be on the ballot.
I don't know if we ever wanted to really call him a major candidate.
For anyone who did.
And then I think notably in the first, Randy Bryce, Iron Stash, did not get on. Did that field narrow at all? Because I know there's like 8 or 9 Democrats trying to run in that race.
Yes,
besides that one, was there anyone else who didn't make it?
No, there were 3 that made it, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Oh, that's
right?
It?
3 in the first, I believe. You can fact check me later.
Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot.
No, I believe it was 3. Yeah, you can look later and then tell me how wrong I was.
Okay,
I believe it was pretty soon.
Does that mean that people should be able to go to myvote.wi.gov as like next week to be able to see what's on their ballot come
August
11th?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be finalized tomorrow.
Okay,
yeah, the Election Commission meets Tuesday to finalize ballots. And yeah, we're off to the races now.
You're off to the races. So you should check your registration, which you can do at myvote.wi.gov. Yeah. You can check your ballot pretty soon of who you have for a primary in your district. So as we approach that, we'll have more nonpartisan voting information because it is important for you to get out and vote, even in primaries. All right, let's take one more break and we come back. There was a Wisconsin Democrats convention this weekend.
There is.
So we'll ask Matt what he will be looking for at the convention this weekend because there's going to be a straw poll.
Is that a question or a statement?
It's a question, right? But there's going to be like the Democrats are going to vote for their own.
Let's do it.
All right.
You can go do a straw poll. How about?
Yeah, sure. All right. We'll talk about that on the other side of this. All right, Matt Smith, what else you got coming up this week?
Well, look ahead to the convention next week, this upcoming weekend, State Democratic Convention in Madison. There'll be several things that will be kind of curious to watch, right? So you'll hear from all the candidates. We'll see the reception. It'll be curious to see the reception of the candidates.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the governor will speak. This will be his last time at a state Democratic convention, last time as governor. And going back to our previous conversation with tax relief, it'll just be fascinating to see the reception that the governor receives. I'm sure it's going to be warm, right? Unless, I don't know, is it?
I don't know. That's what, I mean, you've talked to more of these people in person as far as, will it just be kind of like a, you know, a waspy Thanksgiving dinner where everyone just pretends everything's fine? Because it clearly behind the scenes is a little tense.
Tense. Yeah. It is. I think Democrats will, I would assume, look big picture, right? Yeah. And I think the message they're going to try to relay is the governor who stood up to the Republican legislature, and whether it be blocked legislation or worked together on agreements or passed whatever. I think they're going to attempt to highlight those stories as opposed to the politics of the day. But we'll see. And the governor has said he's not going to endorse. Maybe he'll offer an endorsement at the convention.
Because there was also questions like, how much is he going to, once we know the Democratic candidates up and down the ballot, how much will he actually help with campaigning?
Well, he told me in our interview after the tax relief deal failed that a lot of them may not even want him on the campaign
trail. Do you think that's true?
I don't know.
He's still popular.
I think according to Marquette, he's the most popular politician in the state right now.
More than Tammy Baldwin?
I believe so.
Okay.
I think U.S. senators' name IDs go down when they're not up for re-election, which is kind of fascinating, right? That's a whole different story to talk about, right?
Like, I love how there's always, despite both of our senators, senior and junior, being in seat for over a decade now.
Yeah.
There's still always that small group that still doesn't have enough information to have an opinion.
Right. I think when you look at favorable and unfavorable, according to the latest polling, Evers is the most
favorable.
It'll be curious to see he's not a political animal, right?
No.
Like he's not rallying around on the campaign trail, right?
It seems like, as far as he's ready to hang out with his grandkids and not deal with maybe some of the BS that you have to when you're in that position.
So, yeah.
And then the final thing was, because I know last big governor's race, 2018, when Evers obviously won, WisPolitics had done a straw poll, and Kelda actually won that back then. So it'll be interesting to me if WisPolitics does another straw poll and...
Yes.
It may give us a little bit more insight, or maybe not, because Kelda obviously didn't win in 2018. But as far as the sentiment
among insiders,
so people who are definitely going to be voting in August, if that is surprising, or if we continue to see what Joe Zepecki thinks is that Mandela is the front runner, or what the polls have said, which is Fran is the front runner. So should be interesting. We'll have you back on Monday to give us all of the details. Thank you so much.
Enjoy the week.
It was
a fast hour.
It always goes pretty fast. But thanks for being here with me.
All right.
We'll be back with Brian Jacobson to talk about IPOs and the market after the news.
The work week is here. Let's begin with your Monday market preview with Annex Wealth Management Chief Economic Strategist, Dr. Brian Jacobson on Point Taken.
Dr. Brian Jacobson, 2 weeks in a row. How are you doing this morning?
Fantastic. Yeah, this is a real treat for me.
Absolutely. So, all right, let's get right into it. I think I sent you over some topics for this morning, plenty to talk about. And yesterday marked 100 days since the war in Iran started. And I read this. So with oil prices right now, they actually are lower than a recent high, right? So we've come down a little bit. And despite the fact that the war is still going on, on and off ceasefire and negotiations, what actually made prices come down a little bit?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of different moving pieces here. So we know that the Strait of Hormuz, where that was really kind of the choke point for about 14, some estimates are 14 million, others are 20 million barrels per day on average going through there. And all of a sudden it's like, well, you've got a big conflict and that's going to stop the traffic going through there. Well, it hasn't completely stopped it. It appears as though that there are some ships that are still navigating through, they're willing to keep on their headlights lights and keep plowing through. There's others that are turning off their lights and actually continuing to move through. So you have what's sometimes called the dark fleet. They don't turn on their transponders. We can't really quantify how many of those vessels are making it through, but there are some reports of that. We also had a very large response from governments. In the United States, we have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that had, before this conflict began, about 410 million barrels of oil in it. Well, we've drawn that down. Now it's closer to about 350, 360 million barrels. So kind of releasing some of those reserves. It wasn't just the United States. It was other governments doing the same thing. They've been able to divert oil. Instead of going on vessels, there are some pipelines that they can go from one coast to the other. So kind of this diversion. Also, China has been really big in terms of, over the last few years, building up their, almost their kind of like their precautionary balance, their rainy day fund of oil. And as a result, they have really just pumped the brakes as far as what they need to import. So it's almost as though China had been preparing for this in terms of building up their inventory, and then others are just kind of adapting to this new reality of a low flow through the Strait of Hormuz there.
Actually, and that's actually, I haven't seen any more recent headlines about some of the other countries and how they're dealing with this, because obviously for us, the prices are high. There's certain countries that were just like running out of oil. Australia at one point saying like we have like 30 days left of oil? So how are other countries handling this right now? And is anyone really up against the ropes?
Well, there are, like Cuba, for example. Well, but Cuba was that was separate from this, right? That was because they were getting their oil from Venezuela, and now they're completely cut off. But you had the Philippines and Sri Lanka. They have told everybody go to a 4-day work week. Also encouraging people to work remotely when they can, so they're beginning to ration oil. In Australia, you're absolutely right. They said that they only had about 30 days inventory. And so people just decided that, you know what, we're going to cut back. So when you get the prices rising, you're going to see people changing their behavior. And we've even seen that in the United States. It's the New York Federal Reserve has looked at some of the data for the month of March. So that was kind of the first shock that we had with oil prices. Those people making $50,000 a year or less reported that on average, they were driving about 7% fewer miles that month. Those people making more than $125,000, they didn't really change their behavior all that much. But yeah, the higher prices just began making people cut back. You've also seen lots of flight cancellations. Some of those routes going from, especially within Europe, some of the international routes, the airline said, hey, with the price of jet fuel where it is, we can't really run this route profitably. And as a result, they just canceled the flight. So there's been a lot of behavioral changes going on.
Is there anything else you're watching or is important to note as we pass this 100-day mark?
I think the key thing is, like, when is this finally going to end? And in a way, I kind of feel like President Trump maybe feels the same way, as when can I get them to come to an agreement? When can I get Iran and Israel to stop having their conflict? We saw that this morning.
Yeah.
In the early trading, so before U.S. markets opened, markets were down, and it looked like we were going to have another day of red on the screen here. And then when it was announced that President Trump, you know, contacted Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, told him, hey, can you kind of, you know, lay off? Can you maybe participate in the ceasefire here with Lebanon? And now it looks like maybe we can get to maybe this uncomfortable situation where at least there isn't the conflict and maybe we can get a negotiated truce.
All right. So moving on from that, IPO news. I had an ad this morning. I think it was in Morning Brew in their daily newsletter. There was an ad for the initial public offering of SpaceX. It's coming. We could see Elon Musk become a trillionaire this week. So what are you watching as we watch SpaceX hit the market?
That's right. Is it going to go to the moon or is it going to crash and burn? I think those are kind of the questions, right? Maybe we really don't know until it starts to trade.
Yeah.
And there has been a lot of things unusual about this initial public offering. I mean, in terms of from a governance perspective, that even after they go public, Elon Musk is going to control, you know, like 85% of the shares. So you have what we call a lot of key person risk here in terms of his vision. And that's where it really seems like he wants to get a very large retail following. Typically with initial public offerings, they do this road show where they go and talk to a bunch of institutional investors like pensions, endowments, mutual funds, and try to, that's where they're going to raise the money. This, it seems like it's been more like a grassroots campaign, trying to get the retail public much more interested in participating. And some brokerage firms, they're really lowering their standards as far as what it takes to be able to maybe participate in it. Some of them that used to be you'd have to have like at least $100,000 in your account to at least indicate that you might want to participate. They've lowered it in some instances down to like $2,000. So it does seem like they're trying to maybe create a bit of a feeding frenzy for the first day of trading. And the first day of trading is supposed to be on Friday. So that'll be a really interesting one to see how that plays out.
Well, it is interesting because we had at home, we had this conversation because our broker was like, you know, you can get in on like the early options. You probably know the yeah. terminology better than I do. But then once you, if you do that, you have to stay in for 180 days, right? So it's the gamble of like, how is this going to play after the first week?
Yeah, for those individuals who are thinking that, hey, I want to get in at the offering price and then just flip it, that is a good way to be banned from participating in these in the future. I mean, brokerage firms, they make it very clear. If you are just going to flip this within, sometimes it's 15 days, sometimes it's 30, you know, each one is going to have their own different standards. They're like, you know, we want people to are going to invest and not just gamble. And if your intention is to just see how what all the hype is about, and maybe you'll flip it for a profit within a few days, you might not be able to participate in other initial public offerings going forward for a while.
Yeah. All right. He is Dr. Brian Jacobson, Chief Economic Strategist with Annex Wealth Management. I have a couple more questions as far as what you're going to be watching this week with the SpaceX IPO and what that indicates for Anthropic and some of these other IPOs that are going to be coming. And we'll also talk about some of the new information that we have. Jobs report was out and some more reports for Kevin Warsh to look at when it comes to interest rates. So we will talk to Dr. Brian Jacobson on the other side of this. Welcome back to Point Taken. Steve is out for the rest of the week. I am Kristen Bry. We're talking to Dr. Brian Jacobson, Chief Economic Strategist over at Annex Wealth Management. And so we were just talking about SpaceX IPO this week. What are you watching as this is kind of the first of potentially many of other IPOs, whether it's Anthropic or what else are we expecting to come pretty soon?
That's right. Yeah, this is almost just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe this is the iceberg, just given the valuation where it's at. But yeah, we have Anthropic coming up. We also have OpenAI that they're going to be likely filing their papers as well. And then a lot of other companies as well that maybe aren't quite the household names. But it does look as though for the balance of this year, it's almost like one after another artificial intelligence related IPOs. And I think that's a really interesting story when we look at the economic drivers about growth over the last few years. A lot of investment in data centers and a lot of these companies, what they're really doing is to continue to expand, right? They need to finance this stuff. And sometimes you can finance it with the cash flow that you bring in. That's called like reinvesting, right? You get the cash flow in and then you make these other investments. You can issue debt. That creates a fixed obligation over time. Sometimes it's lower cost because you actually can get some tax write-offs for that when you're a business. And now they're issuing equity. So it's not just about like with SpaceX or Anthropic. Just last week, Alphabet, so the parent company for Google, and then it was also mentioned that Meta, the parent company for Facebook, they're going to be issuing equity as well. Now, keep in mind, if you're an existing investor in these companies and if they issue more stock, that dilutes. So it reduces your share of the overall size, you know, kind of slice of the pie. So your hope is that by them doing this, they can grow the size of the overall pie. So you might get a smaller slice in terms of percentage, but hopefully the pie has grown big enough that you're happy with it. So it's going to be an interesting summer and fall when it comes to a lot of this equity that's being issued.
Well, and that's what was really interesting. I was listening to the podcast Pivot with Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway on Friday, and Scott Galloway was talking about this and how he thought it was a brilliant move from Alphabet and some of these existing companies to get a piece of the pie when they're a more secure bet than some of these newer companies. And so that, I thought that was really interesting as far as, because isn't there concern that there's not enough money Like, for all of these different things, it's like, is there enough market demand to be buying equity in these companies at the rate that they need them to be to continue to build the data centers?
Well, yeah, in order to help finance this, right? And it does feel like a bit of an arms race. That's one of the ways it's been described in the past. Is this going to be a winner-take-all situation where, you know, Alphabet is building, you've also got Microsoft, you've got Meta, you've got Amazon. All these companies are building the data centers, and ultimately, are some of them just going to, you know, fail, or are they all going to succeed? Now, at the stage of investing that we've seen so far, there's been this big ramp up that I don't think we're at the point where there's excess capacity. That's when we start getting a little worried, is have they overbuilt? Now, they've gone from basically zero to this year, it's supposed to be, you know, like $700 billion worth of building. But that's actually not that large when you compare it to the overall size of the economy, the overall size of like construction that has taken place. It's a big part of it, but it's gone from a very low base. So I'm not too worried about it so far. I'm just more interested in terms of pricing, because at what point is it where it's going to be too expensive to actually use some of these models? There's been plenty of reporting around businesses like Uber last week. They had said about how they blew through their artificial intelligence budget within the first 4 months of the year. So there's a little bit of a miss. It's like, are people spending a little bit too much on this? What's the ultimate payoff? And only time will tell.
Absolutely. All right, quickly before we let you go, I know there last week we got on Friday the jobs report came out. Was it Friday? And then this week we're getting the consumer price index report and then the producer price index report. So what makes sense of all of this as far as the information that we're getting and what it's telling us?
Yeah, so the employment situation report was a lot better than expected. We've had 3 months in a row of really solid job gains. Now, that might sound like, hey, that's great news, because it is, but the market reacted kind of negatively, because what's good news for the economy can be bad news if it means that the Fed might decide that they're not going to continue to cut rates, they might pause, or are they going to reverse course? And that's where on Wednesday, when we get the inflation numbers, and we'll be doing an Instant Insight webinar here at Annex about that, is that we're going to really dissect that. Because if the case is that you're at full employment, the labor market's doing well, and the real problem is inflation, that requires a particular policy response. That requires, at some point, probably hiking rates. So earlier in this year, it was like this balancing act. Is the Fed going to have to step in, cut rates to save the labor market? But now it's like, well, labor market's doing just fine. Mm-hmm. But obviously, it really depends on whose labor market. Is it your personal labor market? Because a lot of these macro numbers, remember, it's for the nationwide average. It's not for each individual.
Absolutely. All right. So that is a good plug. Instant Insight, inflation trends happening this Wednesday, June 10th at 9:30 Central Time with Dr. Brian Jacobson. Is there anyone else on that with you, or is it just you handling it all on your own?
Nope. Tom Parks, he's going to be joining. He's our 401k guy.
Perfect. So you got that. And then the following week on June 18th, my 40th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. From 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., there is the Women in Wealth series, Saving the Family Cottage. So you can get all of this if you click the events button on annexwealth.com. And for now, Brian Jacobson, maybe we'll see you again on Monday, 3 weeks in a row, but we'll never
know. That'd be great, a three-peat. Yes.
Three-peat. We love it. All right, Brian Jacobson, as always, thank you for your insight, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you so much.
All right, bye now. We'll come back after this with more Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is, in his words, as I texted him yesterday, he's already devastatingly tan from his, he's on a Caribbean cruise right now. And so he will be back next Monday. So you got me all this week. We have Jake Curtis is actually going to be filling in on Wednesday with me, which I think will be really fun. Todd Alba will be here on Thursday. And then Joe and Bill will be back on Friday after having last Friday off. So full week. Mary Kuhnmensch is going to be here tomorrow for the Mary fans who've been missing her. And so she's going to spend the first hour with us tomorrow. So lots of fun stuff coming up. I was going to talk about Pride, but I don't have enough time now. So we'll talk about Pride on the other side of the news. But I have to mention this because it makes me so happy. So there is a group of professional wrestlers and they're traveling to public libraries all around the country to promote literacy by, let's say, suplexing their way through story time. So the show is called Lucha Libre. And I think it is so much fun because if you think of, obviously, the more traditional Mexican wrestlers, what's the one that, Jazz, you know the name of the ones that are always in Milwaukee? Is it Mucho Libre?
I don't think I've ever heard of these. I only know about
really?
The Crusher, who's
This is different than like WWE wrestling. This is the guys with the masks. And at a lot of Milwaukee events, they'll have it. But this is specifically guys who are going around with those kind of traditional Mexican wrestling masks, but they're promoting literacy, which I think is very awesome.
I think there's like an old venue near my apartment that has their mask painted on them. I wonder if that's what that's
called. So it's Lucha Libre. So this is Lucha Libre, which Libre obviously means book in Spanish. So very fun. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Pride, but first news.
News. I'm Chuck Sievertson. Iran and Israel say they have stopped attacks that reignited over the weekend. ABC's Tom Sufi Burridge in Jerusalem.
It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. They have everything fundamental joy.
Man, this, I wasn't expecting to start the segment this way, but now that Jazz, you start this song, because we said we're going to talk about Pride, which I'm very excited. We had a very fun weekend at Pride. But does this song specifically now conjure up more Pride feelings or more Trump feelings? Has Trump stolen this song?
Did he?
Did you not?
I don't know.
No,
when
he
I
loves
first
this
heard
song.
The song, I hated it because I hated the YMCA going there as a kid. But no, I didn't know Trump was reappropriating it.
Trump loves this song. And it's like a lot of his dance moves is him dancing to this song. So I feel like he's co-opted it now. And so it's not just a Pride song anymore. People have very mixed feelings about it. Obviously, you don't. You didn't know.
You know what? I think there's a more relevant song I could play coming in the next break, but I need to vet
it. I was thinking about this as I was posting things to social media. Is there a Pride anthem this year? I feel like Pink Pony Club was a couple years back.
Oh, I think Pink Pony Club is always the anthem.
I know. There's always going to be like that and like some Lady Gaga songs. Freedom is always going to be up there. But was there a new one this year?
I don't keep track with pop music as much. Okay. I usually just listen to Laura Jane Grace, and she's a transgender icon. So that's anything by her is always going to be an anthem to me. So,
all right, there you go.
The Chaperone, too.
All right. Well, yes, it was Milwaukee's Pride this weekend, and it was actually very fun because we always go to we, as in my husband and I and Frankie, we always make sure that we go to the parade, which is on Sunday. And we had Heidi Dalibor on the show on Friday, who's on the parade's board, talking about all the fun that was happening there. But we ended up having Frankie go to my father-in-law's house on Saturday night. So Mike and I got to be childless and actually go to Pride Fest, which I haven't done in a couple years, at least not into the evening without my kid. And so it was, as always, very fun, very joyful. The weather was perfect. And, you know, and it was funny because I was thinking about this as someone who's always, I mean, I've been going to Pride parades no matter what city I was living in since LA. So basically since the early aughts. And I was thinking about this as far as the idea of like, why do straight people go to Pride or why do straight people support Pride? And it beyond it being a very fun party where everyone feels included and it's fun and you see people expressing themselves how they want to express themselves. It's also, I thought of this analogy as far as, you know, I also don't play for the Packers, but I'm still rooting for them to win. And so it feels like a very similar thing as far as I am rooting for all of my queer friends to win. And what's unfortunate is that we are, as a society, plateauing, if not backsliding, when it comes to support of the LGBTQ community. And it's interesting to me because I'm old enough to remember how quickly public sentiment on this topic, especially gay marriage, flipped overnight, right? Where it felt like in 2008, when Obama and Hillary Clinton were running for president, they were still both talking about, as Democrats, like civil unions and not gay marriage. And then by the end of Obama's second term in 2015, the Supreme Court, Obergefell, came down and the Supreme Court had decided that that was the law of the land, and that, like, how quickly in 8 years, less than 8 years, public sentiment changed as far as just not caring, either not caring or supporting it. And feeling like gay marriage was a right that people decided they should have. And it's interesting now to see, I think as of this came out last week, that Gallup had noticed the trends that after two decades of rising support for LGBTQ, attitudes had plateaued or backslide. So the approval of same-sex marriage and moral acceptance of gay and married and lesbian relations is down like 6 points from where its peak in 2022 and 2023. And it's still the majority, right? Like most Americans still favor legal same-sex marriages. That's at 65%. It's still getting chipped away a little bit. And like they point to Republicans largely being responsible for declining support. And I don't know if this is just a typical two steps forward, one step back when we talk about the arch of justice, and it's not always linear, but it is kind of disappointing. And I'd be interested to hear from some of our Republican listeners if you have shifted, if you felt like you've backslid yourself as far as LGBTQ community and the rights that they have and their struggle. If you're someone who feels like, quote unquote, it went too far, but it's still incredibly important to show up as a straight person at these events, because they still are a minority of the community that we live in and need as many people as possible cheering for them and cheering for them to demand their humanity. And so I love Pride. It is such a fun weekend, and who doesn't love a bunch of rainbows and stickers and great music and great dancing? And so it was very fun to partake. If you had fun this weekend, I'd love to hear your stories of what you enjoyed. There's also, I mean, Jazz, you probably know, what other Pride events across Wisconsin do we have? Kenosha's is coming up soon?
Yes, I believe it's coming in July, as well as Watertown's.
Okay. All right, there you go. So there are more opportunities to celebrate if you missed this weekend. All right, but when we come back, kind of talking about dating. I mean, obviously, when you are someone who's gay, you're like, there's a litmus test, right? Like, you need to be a certain gender for me to be attracted to you. But now there's all these dating apps for other litmus tests of, you know, what you eat, what your political ideology is, and now if you are an anti-vaxxer or not. So I have a discussion as far as what deal breakers deserve their own like dating apps and which ones don't, and how helpful are they actually? So stay with us on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is out for the week. He will be back next Monday. And still a big week of shows. Lots of fun guests. So we hope you'll be here every day to listen in with us. And so I think I've talked about this before, but my husband and I met on a dating app, as many people do these days. We met on Hinge. And the funny story there is that I had signed up for Hinge before I had officially moved to Milwaukee back in 2020. I was still living at my parents' house in Wisconsin Rapids. And I had decided that I was going to move to Milwaukee and not go back to LA. And I wanted to, you know, full disclosure, kind of check out the dating scene and see what the guys were like in Milwaukee before I got here, and happened to match with my husband, my now husband, before I moved. And so he nicely asked, he's like, can I take you out? And I was like, well, I don't actually live in Milwaukee yet. And to his credit, we continued to talk up until me actually moving here. And then, as they say, the rest is history. But I am very pro dating app. I think there is parts of dating apps that have introduced different struggles to dating as far as just kind of the endless swiping, and we're starting to see the backlash to that. But it still is, you know, it's a way to get yourself out there. My first dating app was back in 2013 when Tinder had first come out, and I was single in San Francisco. And so it certainly has revolutionized how we date, and certainly there's a lot of people now who have met their spouse or their current partner on a dating app. But what's funny is also there is now all of these spin-offs of these apps that create their own groups. And I think the purpose of them is to typically to, if you have a deal breaker, if you want to find someone who is this thing and don't want to have to be in the bigger dating pool of sifting through people who may or may not be a part of that group, you know, there's a place for you. So what do these different apps include? So there's one called Vegly, I think is how you pronounce it. V-E-G-G-L-Y. So it's for vegan and vegetarian dating. There's one called Dig, apparently, for dog people, and it matches based on dog ownership and lifestyle. There's a similar one for Tabby, which is for cat people. There's one for single parents called Stir, or Frollo is another single parent one. Farmers D, which is, what do you imagine, is for farmers and ranchers. And I think there's J Swipe, which there was originally J Date. I think that was before it was maybe just an app. Chispa, which is the Latino dating app. So there's all these different ones that if you are specifically looking for this type of person, no matter what, you can sign up for these apps and meet that kind of person and not have the rigmarole of having to figure it out after you've matched. But now, Wired had an article out this morning that I found for specifically for anti-vax dating apps, which I guess makes sense. If you are very adamant about being anti-vax and you only want to date someone who is anti-vax, like it makes sense as it being its own dating app. Because I'm not sure on a normal like Hinge where all are welcome type dating app or Tinder or Bumble, like if you put directly in your profile, I am anti-vax, like what conversation maybe that stirs up? But I also just want to, like, the names for these apps are also, I mean, they're pretty funny. So there's more than one, which I think is interesting. But one is called Unjected. There's one called Pureblood.dating. There's Unjabbed. No Vax Singles. And then Unjuiced Date. I didn't know Juiced was... I've never heard of that one as far as it being related to vaccines. But I don't know. I mean, this obviously the Wired article was a little critical because they're also doing these meetups. But I don't think this is a bad thing as far as if this is something that is like really important to you. And like I said, I hear the conversations of my friends who are still on dating apps of as far as what they're trying to decipher from profiles as far as their political leanings, how they feel about vaccinations and stuff. And so I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to kind of create your own groups and if that's going to be really important to you in the dating scene. And the only, I don't know, devil's advocate that I see with it is continuation of sorting ourselves and making, you know, our hobbies... Well, not that anti-vax is a hobby, but it's just like being so committed to these different things that are baked into our identity that you continue to make your circle or your dating choices smaller and smaller because you have such a high bar for all of the criteria they need to make or need to be part of. And I think that's the biggest thing that I was thinking about as far as what these dating apps and these communities of anti-vax people, because like, you know, it brings up the conversation about autonomy and all of these different things and your kids. But I guess if you're both anti-vax, it becomes a much easier conversation if you do have kids. But I don't know. I would be interested to see if other people think this is a limitation on dating by having these smaller, more insular groups based on certain criteria or if it's a really good thing. But it was just something that I thought was interesting as far as modern dating. So, all right, when we come back, we will wrap up today's show. So stay with us on Point Taken.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied.
It's a good one. Best music. That's what I'm saying. The best music is at Pride. I love that someone called in. What was it, Richard?
Richard in Illinois. Yep.
Richard in Illinois,
especially during the Friday show.
Yeah, called in and said, "I am too young to be using the word rigmarole," which is fair. At least I don't say Katie bar the door as often as Todd and Steve do. What's another one that Steve said? Steve said something else recently that I was like, "This is, I do not know this reference," but I like the word rigmarole. It's fun to say. It might be an old person's word, but who cares? It's a fun word to say, and I don't know if there's a good synonym to replace it as far as the
you know, what, the obstacles and the challenges of getting something done. Rigmarole is way more fun to say than that. All right. Well, we had a very fun show today. Great to have Matt here for a full hour. Great to talk to Brian about all the happenings in the market this week. And so coming up tomorrow, for all of the Judge Mary fans, she hasn't been here in a while. And so she's coming back for a full hour tomorrow to talk about, I'm sure we may, I think we have some Hannah Dugan updates, some Supreme Court stuff that's coming out. So plenty to talk about with her. And then we also have a upcoming event that I'm actually going to be moderating at the end of this month about high-speed rail in Wisconsin. And I know people, this is one of those topics that I think a lot of people get passionate about. I obviously was not living in Wisconsin when the train, the Walker train between Madison and Milwaukee event occurred, and our lack of a train. But there's an event coming up at the end of the month talking about what it would take to get high-speed rail in Wisconsin. And you probably can guess, because I'm moderating the event, where I land on the issue. But we're going to talk about that tomorrow with a guest ahead of the event. And then later this week, we got Jake Curtis, we got Todd Alba, we got Joe and Bill. Plenty happening. But thank you for listening today. We will be back tomorrow, and news is next.